The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
My guest is John Eastman. He is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service, Dale E. Fowler School of Law at Chapman University. Professor John Eastman, Dr. Eastman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on your program, Larry.
I want to start with a sound clip, a very small one, that really sets things up by what's so strange about the impeachment inquiry. And this is the famed Nancy Pelosi sound clip in which she is telling the president if he has something that would make him innocent, he needs to come forward with that. Kind of the old witch trial. If you sink, you're innocent. If you float, you're guilty. The impossible thing. Let's take a listen to that and talk about it. All right, here we go.
Do not think that the House is dead set on a course to impeach the president when all of this milieu is going on.
Well, all this milieu is a seeking of the truth. It's called an inquiry. And if the president has something that it is exculpatory, Mr. President, that means you have anything that shows your innocence, then he should make that known. And that's part of the inquiry.
All right. Your reaction, Professor.
Well, it certainly runs counter to the longstanding American tradition, and dating back even to the English tradition before that, of presumed innocence until proven guilty. And Speaker Pelosi here is quite explicitly flipping the table on that. We're going to presume him guilty, even though we have no evidence of it. But if he has evidence to prove his innocence, then maybe we'll back off. Maybe.
So how can they do that? How can the world sit there? Is this, I mean, you're a professor, you're up there, you have kind of the knowledge base. Are most people just kind of not really very knowledgeable in history, and the media doesn't really think about it? That, it seems like it gets a pass card.
Well, it gets a pass card on the left. The media are covering for this, and the most outrageous things that are being stated, the most important shredding of basic constitutional protections that is going on, that would have the media screaming bloody murder that had happened during the prior administration, are routinely shoveled under the rug in order to push a narrative that is just patently false. And it is the most extraordinary thing. Now, can they do it? Well, they got a majority votes, and if they're going to do a jam down, they have the ability to do that just by the raw votes. That doesn't make it just. It doesn't make it legitimate. And I think this thing will blow up in the Senate if it ever gets to that. It's certainly starting to blow up with the American people, who are increasingly growing tired of the charade that is being put out. And we now know this is nothing new. They've been trolling around for some hook to place an impeachment proceeding on since the day after the president was elected, and certainly since the day he was inaugurated. And, you know, and they've gone from one hook that didn't pan out to another hook that didn't pan out. They now think they've got a hook that might pan out, except they're not getting any evidence to do it. But that doesn't matter, because the goal here is to depose the president who was duly elected.
Now, here's the next clip I want to play for you. Take a listen to this. This is the question of whether Adam Schiff is lying when it comes to having known, or his office having talked to, the whistleblower. He is denying it, makes this point this last week.
Because I can't let it go unanswered. Some of my colleagues made the statement repeatedly that I've met with the whistleblower, that I know who the whistleblower is. It was false the first time they said it. It was false the second through 40th time they said it. It will be false the last time they say it.
All right, is he parsing words there? Because there were some reports that the whistleblower had talked to his staff, and that maybe it was even coordinated, that he may have even helped get him the attorney. Sort this out. What do we know?
Well, the first statement he made on this was blatantly false. He said, "We have never met with the whistleblower." That turned out to be patently false, because the whistleblower did meet with Schiff's staff. So now you'd see that he's carefully changed the "we" to "I." I never met the whistleblower. Well, you know, that's just not the way things work in Congress. The staff tend to do a lot of the legwork. So I have no doubt that maybe the staff, we know the staff met with him. But the issue is whether Schiff and his staff and the committee know who the whistleblower is. As a collective body, they most certainly do. And so lip, by now changing the word from we to I, shift is almost, you know, doing the same kind of thing. Well, it depends on what the meaning of is. The fact of the matter is his people know who the whistleblower is. I find it hard to believe that they have not advised him of that fact. But that doesn't matter. The fact is the staff of Adam Schiff know who the whistleblower is.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the testimony. And last week we heard from someone who lost their job. They didn't get to continue on and be the envoy or the diplomat dealing with Ukraine. And it was all pointed out, and everybody had to admit, it's perfectly the job of the president to be able to choose whom he wishes to have work for him. How do you go past that argument? I don't get that.
Well, you don't. And in fact, what we didn't see here is what has traditionally happened. Usually upon the change of administration, ambassadors around the world send a letter tendering their resignation. The president can decide to accept those letters or reject them. But that's just the normal course. It also happens with the senior executive service and the domestic agencies in Washington. What we have found instead with this transition is that didn't happen. And people are holding on as holdovers because the president, and then making it difficult for the president to have his own people in. And then when he does try and get his own people in, screaming bloody murder that he illegitimately got rid of me. These people serve at the will of the president. And the arrogance of these folks to say, you know, the president's efforts to try and look at Ukrainian corruption and the amount of money flowing from the United States to corrupt Ukrainian companies and then back through that to American political officials and their families, that it's somehow, contrary to U.S. policy to try and find out what's going on there, contrary to their version of U.S. policy, but it's not them that sets U.S. policy. It's the president that sets U.S. policy. And we have specific statutory requirements that in the giving out of U.S. aid, we're supposed to look at whether that U.S. aid is being corruptly used. So the president is following not only his own policy instincts on this, but the acts of Congress that require it. To the contrary of what these, you know, bureaucrats in the State Department, holdovers from the Obama administration, are trying to hide.
Yeah. Let's listen to one of them. This is a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. This week claimed President Trump's July phone call with the president of Ukraine was inappropriate.
It is improper for the president of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
All right. Talk about that, because, you know, if anyone chooses to run for president, does that mean they're immune from something that took place in the past? I don't think so.
Well, I don't think so. And in fact, if that U.S. political opponent had been engaged in corruption with the foreign government, as we know, we've got enough facts of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and a guy whose name doesn't show up very often, but his name is Devin Archer. He was the guy appointed the day after Joe Biden visited Ukraine. He was appointed to Burisma board about 2 weeks before Hunter Biden was appointed. Who is this guy? He was the top fundraiser in the 2004 presidential campaign of John Kerry, who had just become Secretary of State, overseeing, among other things, Ukrainian policy, and was contemplating another run for president in 2016. And a series of these questions about where did all that U.S. money go through Burisma, that some of it made its way back into a company co-owned by Hunter Biden and Devin Archer. I mean, you know, and you look at the USAID, normal annual USAID from the State Department to Ukraine has been about $20 million. The few months after those appointments to Burisma's board were made, that aid jumped by $100 million to $118 million. It spiked the moment that Hunter Biden and Devin Archer are put on that board. The money's going through Ukraine to this corrupt company and then back to Hunter Biden and Devin Archer. Why is that not an appropriate area of inquiry or instead of being off limits? It's not an invitation to influence the election. It's an invitation to help us get to the bottom of USAID being corruptly used and funneled to American politicians.
Professor John Eastman is with us. Let's listen to Devin Nunes, the Republican, on the panel, as he does a great job of clarifying things, just one, two, three, that kind of put things in place. Listen to just one of those.
Okay. None of these are trick questions. I'm just trying to get through the
record. I understand.
Yeah. Did you know that Burisma lawyers pressured the State Department in February 2016 after the raid and month before the firing of Shokin, and that they invoked Hunter Biden's name as a reason to intervene?
I was not aware.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Poroshenko at least three times in February 2016 after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
Not at the time. Again, I've become aware of that through this proceeding.
Thank you.
I mean, these things kind of knock down these individuals who just feel uncomfortable about a call when they're bigger fish to fry here that they're not even caring about.
Well, that's right. And you know, and former Ambassador Yovanovitch, too, you know, concerned about U.S. pressure on Ukraine when we had Joe Biden bragging about him threatening to cut off over $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees if they didn't stop an investigation that was looking into the company on whose board his son sat. And we now know that that prosecutor was about to seek an interview with Hunter Biden himself. She had no concern about that. In fact, she claimed she didn't even know that Joe Biden had taken was bragging about that, even though that's common knowledge by now. Somebody that is so central to this inquiry to say something like that under oath, I think it's just so incredible as to clearly qualify as perjury, in my view.
But it's not about the truth here. It's about swirling this around and bringing about a vote. They know it's going to get knocked down in the Senate. What's the long game here? What's the strategy on the part of the Democrats putting together such a shoddy case?
Well, I think there are two. I think the most urgent one for them is to try and distract from the indictments that we expect to be coming down fairly shortly because of the use of FBI, CIA, NSA, State Department, Department of Justice, the White House National Security Council to interfere in the 2016 election, to create a false narrative against President Trump, and to use the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement community to further that political agenda. I think people ought to be going to jail. I think there are going to be indictments handed down, and the more muck they can throw up into the whole discussion to try and soften that blow, I think is strategy number one. Strategy number two, if there are any people left sitting on the fence about the 2020 election, to try and skew some of the narrative against Trump to try and prevent his reelection. They know that there's no possibility of getting a conviction on an impeachment, but they think by tagging the president as an impeached president, that will be sufficient.
With that, I got to leave it there. Professor John Eastman, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.